Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 18, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call examining tensions between federal and state marijuana laws. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. All expressions of opinion on the call today are those of the experts. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts for today's call are Professor Randy Barnett and Mr. McGregor Scott. We'll hear opening remarks of about 5 to 10 minutes from each, some general discussion, and then we'll get to your questions. Randy Barnett is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at the Georgetown University Law Center. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes today, he argued the 2004 Gonzalez v. Raich medical marijuana case in the Supreme Court and also represented Ms. Raich from day one in that litigation. He's also a former prosecutor. McGregor Scott is a partner at Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, where his practice focuses on white-collar crime and corporate investigations. Also importantly for our purposes today, he was the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California. He has over 20 years of experience as a prosecutor, and it was the Eastern District of California, I understand, in which Ms. Raich actually resided, although her case began before McGregor Scott was the U.S. Attorney. Now, as always, their more complete bios are available on the Federalist Society website and in the notices you receive for today's call, so I'm not going to introduce them any further. And with that, Professor Barnett, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. Thanks for inviting me to do this. I always enjoy these teleforums. I suppose I do have one more somewhat embarrassing admission to make about my background, given the topic of today's call, and that is I've never smoked marijuana in my life. It's somewhat embarrassing given my age, meaning I was up in the 60s and the 70s when marijuana was very prevalent. You had to be sort of square to avoid smoking marijuana, but somehow I managed to do that. Nevertheless, I think that these marijuana initiatives that are now taking place throughout the country, we've now seen two states who have decriminalized the recreational use of marijuana, are great public policy. It's something that's long overdue. We can talk about why that might be later on, but I welcome this, and I also think it's a vindication of federalism. We live in a country in which different people have different preferences in the kinds of communities they want to live in, and the fact that we have 50 states allows those preferences to be expressed in different ways, and so it's great that two states have decided to do this, and there's a public policy implication of that as well. Which is that instead of constantly speculating about what's going to happen if you adopt a policy and then being afraid to do so, we get to experiment with what happens when you adopt a policy, and we'll get to find out whether some of the horror stories that people have been saying for decades about what it would be like to have legalized or decriminalized recreational marijuana are going to come to pass. We'll find out, and then we'll be able to go forward more knowledgeably. So that's all very good. The other day, I did get a call from a reporter from the New York Times telling me that he'd heard rumors that the Justice Department was thinking of bringing an action to invalidate these local laws on the grounds that they were preempted by federal law, and wanted to know my opinion of it. It's not something that I've given a tremendous amount of thought to, although obviously preemption did figure into the Raich litigation, but my response basically was I've been hearing this kind of talk for a long time, ever since the Raich case, and frankly, it just seems preposterous to me, at least with respect to most of what these initiatives actually do. Now, I should say, based on my experience in the healthcare challenge, I don't lightly and don't believe that we should dismiss theories as frivolous until we've had a good deal of time to hear what the arguments are. And I told the reporter, let me hear what the argument is, and then I'll have a better idea of whether it has any merit. But without having heard any argument per se, I start off with the position by saying it's true that federal laws do preempt state laws that are inconsistent with it insofar as the states are doing something that federal law justly prohibits. But By the same token, we have a very long-standing principle, and that is that the federal government may not commandeer state governments to do its bidding, and it may not commandeer legislatures to pass laws, and it may, which is the New York case, and it may not commandeer executive branch officials to enforce laws, which is the Prince case. And so we have an ironclad bar from the Supreme Court, barring the federal government from commanding or commandeering state governments to do its bidding. And it would seem to me that the states are under no obligation whatsoever to make any particular kind of conduct illegal. That if the federal government does have power to make something illegal, they may do so. But states don't have to make conduct illegal. Feds can go first, make conduct illegal. So there's absolutely no obligation on the part of any state to hold that the use of marijuana or any other activity is illegal. If the federal government has a power to do that, it may do so. And when the states decline to put their law enforcement resources behind the same policy, they are not doing anything inconsistent with federal law. They are simply minding their own business and letting federal law operate the way federal law can operate. And if the feds find they can't enforce their own laws, well, that's the feds' business. They can't dragoon or commandeer state officials to do their bidding. And so for that reason, ending a policy of criminalization and going back to the original position of activity being legal, which it always could have been, states were under no obligation to pass those laws in the first place. They're under no obligation to continue to enforce those laws or to even keep them on the books. And as I know as a state court prosecutor, state court prosecutors drop marijuana charges all the time. They fail to prosecute. They fail to approve marijuana charges all the time. They are not doing something unconstitutional under federal law because they have failed to prosecute marijuana offenders. So in this regard, I don't see any problem at all. The only type of problem that might be, that might come closer to the line, and we can talk about this later. I won't say any more about it now because I'll let Greg go next. And that is when states, under some of these statutes, set up regulatory mechanisms to see to it that the right people are using marijuana and it's being kept out of the hands of the wrong people, which is primarily minors. Is somehow that preempted by federal law because at that point they are regulating this conduct? And I just think the short answer to that is no. They are basically restricting the liberties of their citizens. They're not prohibiting them from using marijuana, but they're saying if they choose to use marijuana, they're going to have to do it a certain way. They're going to have to, obtain a license to distribute, and they're going to have to make sure that they don't sell to minors. And for states to restrict the liberties of their citizens in this way, but letting them to do this action anyway, seems to me perfectly within their purview and not inconsistent with federal law. But I do think that comes, a little closer to the line. But the idea that states are going to get out of the business of enforcing marijuana laws or marijuana prohibition is not something that the feds can command them to do otherwise. And that would be how I'd start. Greg, I guess it's your turn.
Right. So let me just start out by saying that I think I have to join Randy in the square category because I grew up in Humboldt County, California, in the late 70s and very early 80s, which I think for many folks know that as the Emerald Triangle. And I likewise have never smoked marijuana in my life. So we've got the two squares talking about marijuana today. I think the question that lays over all of this, which Randy mentioned at the beginning, is what are the feds going to do? So I think if we look at it from a legal perspective, we have a law, a federal statute, which was passed by the Congress, signed into the law by the president, which says that there is no legal purpose or justification for possessing, growing, cultivating, dispensing marijuana. It has no legal purpose. We have a Supreme Court case in the Raich case in which the court upheld the constitutionality of that law. We also have the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution. So if we look at it from a legalistic perspective, I think it's very clear from the legal perspective that federal law preempts the state law. The absolute ban on marijuana under federal law preempts the state law, irrespective whether it's a medical marijuana law like we have here in California or whether it's a simple possession law as passed by Colorado and Washington. So the question becomes, what are the feds going to do about it? Now, in a very practical perspective, I don't anticipate in any way, shape, or form, and I say this based on my experience as the United States Attorney here in Sacramento for 6 years during the Bush administration, the feds could care less, and I don't mean to be cynical about it, but in large measure, they could care less about simple possession of marijuana other than on federal property, military bases, national parks, those kinds of things. So the simple possessors of marijuana in Colorado and Washington, frankly, don't have a lot to be concerned about because the feds don't have the time or the resources to go after this. There has been, in essence, a hiring freeze across the U.S. Attorney's offices for much of the Obama administration, which remains in effect. So they do not have the resources to be overly concerned about simple possessors. The rubber is going to meet the road when each of these states comes forward with its regulations or statutes about how someone who wants to have marijuana will get that marijuana. Colorado has a process where there's a panel that's being appointed that's going to develop these processes. In Washington, a state agency is going to develop these processes. And it's that sale and distribution angle that may cause attention or focus from the feds. And we'll have to really wait and see what schemes or devices the states come up with to see how the feds are going to react to that. So I don't know that we're really going to be able to answer this question today. The president, I think, said last week that this is not going to be a big priority for the Justice Department. The one other point I would make, again, having served as the U.S. attorney here, is that those who advocated for this bill, those who intend to have their marijuana under these statewide propositions, need to be very careful not to overdo it. And what I mean by that is that, okay, the law is now the law in Colorado and in Washington, but don't overdo it. And by way of example, I saw a photograph in the newspaper last week of a bunch of people lighting up and smoking marijuana at the base of the Space Needle in Seattle. Well, those kinds of grandstanding gestures are like putting a stick in the eye of the federal government. And as the late, great Jim Croce once said, you don't tug on Superman's cape. So don't overdo it. And frankly, much of the problem here in California with the medical marijuana law is that the proponents of this thing are so over the top and how brazen they are about it, the number of just outright selling dispensaries and storefront operations, it provoked a response from the feds, a dramatic response from the feds, from the Obama administration, which has resulted in shutting down many, many, many of these stores, marijuana stores across the state, and has created a huge tension between the feds and the locals. So we'll just have to see what they do with the regulations because, again, limited resources, limited time, limited ability to go after this, but the sales and distribution, that will be the issue where the feds will decide whether they're going to do something about it.
Okay, we're going to get to audience questions, but before we do that, Randy, Professor Barnett, let me give you a minute or two to respond to anything you heard and augment your opening remarks.
Sure. I'm not totally sure I understand what Greg means by the ban preempt state law. There's no question. If all he means by that is that the federal law is operative in the states which have authorized or decriminalized marijuana use, I agree entirely. State law does not preempt federal law. The feds are perfectly free to enforce their laws either against individual possessors if they decide they want to spend their resources that way, or against people who sell and distribute in violation of the Controlled Substances Act. They can, as they do in California, under federal law, go after dispensaries because they are violating federal law even though they're operating legally under state law. So that's all true. I don't disagree with any of that. The only question is whether somehow the feds can go to court and stop the operation of the state law, either by declaring the law, having the law declared unconstitutional so that marijuana must remain criminal in these states, which I think is, I won't call it a frivolous argument, but I think it's a very tenuous argument. I would predict, and I don't like making court predictions, but I would predict it would fail all the way up. I could imagine it actually failing 9-0 at the Supreme Court, a challenge like that. And so I don't think that, I mean, there's talk about the feds bringing a legal action, and I just think that that legal action is not going to succeed if they do. Then there's the sort of in-between issue about, and this is what Greg got into at the end, when the states set up these regulatory mechanisms, whether somehow they can argue that these mechanisms are themselves illegal or unconstitutional. Why would they do that? Well, it cannot be on the theory that the states are themselves distributing or selling. So the states will not themselves be in violation of federal law by setting up these mechanisms. The only theory I can think of as to what they would say is that somehow they're aiding and abetting people who are selling by developing a regulatory mechanism. And in that sense, they would be in violation of federal law, and federal law would trump state law. But I just don't think if we actually have to litigate this, that regulation of these activities in the sense of telling you how to behave when you're doing it and keeping this stuff out of the hands of minors and making sure that the products are safe, I don't think that's aiding and abetting. I think that's controlling. In fact, the Controlled Substances Act itself has several categories of controlled substances, some of which are banned and some of which are controlled. And we certainly don't think that that's inconsistent. Controlling is not inconsistent with federal law, and controlling at the state level is not inconsistent with federal law, even though it does allow these activities to happen. But that would be the only thing in which there might be a legal challenge that we'd have to start thinking hard about. But other than that, I agree that as a prudential matter, I think people ought to behave themselves in a respectful way. But on the other hand, I think if marijuana activists had not been in the streets and behaving in a somewhat provocative way, I doubt we would have had this legal change. I mean, you have to sort of, democracy can sometimes get a little bit ugly, and that's how we get legal change. I do think, I have no doubt that most of the legal use of marijuana is going to be taking place by responsible adults behind closed doors in ways in which we never know. That's how marijuana is used today, by millions of people illegally, but in a responsible manner behind closed doors, and you never know about it, and you're going to continue to not know about it.
Greg Scott, do you want to take a minute or two?
Well, I think the concept, I mean, really, the essential question is: are the feds going to bring an action on a preemption argument? I mean, that really is the nut of it. I think the states can lawfully pass these laws, and the question becomes: what are the feds going to do, and are they going to bring the action? So that's really, I think, what it's going to boil down to. And I come back to my point about the distribution or sale mechanisms that are being developed by the states, and that's really, I think, where the feds will base their decision one way or the other. And I think, you know, as a prosecutor, I guess maybe I would disagree slightly with Randy that the concept that if the state is facilitating the distribution or sale of marijuana, that's a pretty clear-cut aiding and abetting criminal theory. Not that it's one I'd ever want to take to a jury, but it is a fairly clear-cut criminal theory of a case, because you are facilitating the distribution of a banned substance, facilitating the sale of a banned substance. So we'll just have to see where that leads and plays out.
Greg, if I could just interrupt, just
sure,
to be clear,
sure.
The facilitating theory is going to apply to the activities in these that are authorized by these statutes to try to protect the health and safety of California, of Coloradans and Washingtonians from marijuana use. So the federal government will be in the odd position if they do this. And I sort of at the end of the day think they're not going to. But if they were to bring an action like this, they're basically saying the parts of the laws that were the health and safety part of the laws are the ones that Colorado can't do. All they can do is let people use marijuana in an unregulated manner. If they try to regulate the use and to protect from, you know, it getting in the hands of minors, for example, that's unconstitutional because it's been preempted. I suspect that courts are not going to be all that sympathetic to the health and safety part of these laws being struck down while they are forced to uphold the rest of the laws, because to do otherwise would be to commandeer the state. So that's just my instinct.
No, and I don't, I mean, please.
No, I was about to say, and so I guess I just don't, to close the circle here, I don't see regulating the use of this stuff as facilitating the use of this stuff. When I think of a facilitation theory, I'm thinking of an assistance theory, facilitating, for example, in order to, get the car, buy the car for the people to transport the goods, put up the money in order for them to set up their grow labs. I can think of a lot of ways you can facilitate things. I think telling people that a place has to be safe and that they're not allowed to sell to minors, I don't view that as a facilitation. I think your instinct in saying you wouldn't want to bring it to a jury is a pretty good one, because I wouldn't want to bring it to a jury.
No, I think that's right. But I would say that issuing a business license, telling a marijuana store how they can operate, is much more tenuous than simply saying you can't sell to minors. So I don't want to belabor the point. I just want to say that that's really, I think, where it's going to come down to with respect to how the feds are going to look at this thing.
And just for the purposes of the people who are listening to this, when they're anticipating how these arguments are going to go, the way I would characterize a business license is essentially telling everybody else who doesn't have a license that they may not distribute marijuana. So a licensing scheme is simply a way of restricting access to the distribution of marijuana. It's not a way of expanding it. In the absence of a licensing scheme, everybody can distribute marijuana. In the presence of a licensing scheme, only the people who have the license can do it. That's not facilitating. That's restricting. It's restricting all the people who don't have a license, and it's allowing the people who do have a license to do what they would do in the absence of a licensing scheme. So I think that's, and I think what the callers are getting, and what the people who are calling in are going to get here, is sort of a preview of how that kind of argument is going to go.
Well, if you are issuing a business license for the sale of a banned federal substance, I think you could see the other side of what you just said. So,
Greg, this is Dean. I wonder, were you headed in the direction of saying something more about your thoughts on preemption?
No. What I was going to say is just that as a side view, I do think that, and this is based on my experience here in California, I spent 6 years as an elected district attorney and 6 years as the U.S. attorney trying to make sense of the medical marijuana law here in California. And I do think it's very good from that perspective that in both of these statutes they have limited amounts that can be lawfully possessed, and they also have set up a mechanism or a structure by which there's a means of acquiring your lawful marijuana under state law. We don't have either of those things under California's law. It's been an unmitigated disaster for everybody, those who claim to be medical marijuana patients, law enforcement, everybody. And so I think, from that practical perspective, these laws were much better drafted than what's happened here in California. And I think because of that, there may be less incentive for the feds to take any action.
Can I agree with something that Greg just said there? And that is that one of the objections that I always heard on the medical to medical marijuana dispensaries in California and elsewhere is that they're not really just selling it to the people who are qualified, and doctors are giving out these permissions or authorizations for marijuana willy-nilly. And my response to that was always, that's what regulation is for. If, in fact, there's a distinction, if you're not allowed to use it for recreational purposes and you're not allowed to sell it for recreational purposes and you're only allowed to sell it for medical reasons, then it's up to the state of California to regulate this stuff. And that's where your complaint should be filed. I mean, and in fact, some of the threats of preemption, I don't know how true this is, so I've just read this, so I can't say this is a matter that I have personal knowledge of. But partly I've heard that there's one thing that inhibits state legislators from setting up these regulatory regimes is a fear that the regulatory regimes will be preempted by federal law, where just letting people do it is not preempted by federal law. And that's why it would be very unfortunate, I think, if that's what the feds would decide to do, is try to preempt the very features of this law that Greg likes, which is that it's trying to protect the health and safety of the public while allowing people to use this substance. And I think that there's probably been an inadequate amount of regulation in California, and I think that's on the state of California to fix.
All right. This is Dean again. Why don't we go to the audience for questions? We've got almost 100 people on the line. I'm sure they have questions. You should hear a prompt in a moment that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. And while the folks are lining up, let me ask a question of either one of you. What do you have to say about a situation where the federal government now doesn't enforce federal laws in Colorado or Washington, but fairly aggressively, we have a U.S. attorney in Utah that's enforcing the federal marijuana law. Does that create any problems? Does the defendant there have an issue raising some kind of equal protection claim because this federal law is not being applied or aggressively enforced in Colorado or Washington State?
Well, I would say that there's a great likelihood that the type of person prosecuted in Utah, namely those who are selling, distributing large amounts of marijuana, are exactly the same type of person who will continue to be prosecuted by the feds in Washington and Colorado. I would go back to my earlier point that absent some connection to federal property, a military base, a national park, the feds are not in the business of prosecuting people for simple possession. And again, the resources are so limited that in a practical sense, only those who are involved in very large grow sites, very large distribution rings, very large sales organizations, irrespective of whether the state is Utah or Colorado, will face federal prosecution.
Professor Barnett, did you want to weigh in here, or should we turn to the audience?
No, I'll let us go on.
Okay. We've got a number of people lined up with questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll try and get to as many of these questions as possible.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. I recognize that politics is the art of the possible and that reasonable people can disagree on all these topics. But it seems to me that number one, there's no real medical, scientific, or anecdotal proof that recreational use of marijuana does anybody any particular harm. Number two, that the real harm comes from the legalization of the drug that leads to Mexican drug cartels, violence, and the overconsumption of government resources, including the militarization of what should be civil police forces in trying to stop and interdict the importation of this stuff and the growth and distribution of it. And third, that no matter what your views on this are, to have a policy that says we're going to let any kind of user, if it's not, if the use is not flagrant and public, get away with it, but we're going to go hardcore after the people who are distributing it, is as totally incoherent as our immigration policy, which in some ways is intertwined with the drug policy. And so I'd be interested in both sides' responses to whether it doesn't make more sense to adopt basically an all-or-nothing approach. Let's legalize it, tax it, and ensure its safe distribution, or let's decide that it is evil and it's wrong, and we are going to do everything that we can to stop it, including at the border, including in the grow labs, including in the distribution centers, and including in the privacy of people's homes, because if there were no consumption, there would be no demand, and we would not have any of the other associated problems.
Well, let me just say, because I think Greg's going to have more to say about this than I do, I agree with every word that Applegate just said, including the ands and the buts.
Thank you, Ann.
I don't agree as a fundamental premise that there are no studies showing that marijuana use has a negative effect, because I think...
Okay, well, Paul McCartney writes worse songs now than he did 40 years ago. I'll grant you that. But
yeah, and I know there have been studies out of the UK which show profound psychosis and other detrimental brain and physical aspects to it. So I don't accept that premise. Number two, obviously, the violence here, but also in Mexico. I mean, all these drug deaths in Mexico that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years with the Calderon government's war on the drug cartels stems from the insatiable appetite for drugs in the United States. And so there is I hate to use the term collateral damage, but that's a huge part of it. I don't dispute that. It's a huge part of it. But I don't think that simply legalizing it and walking away solves the problem of illegal organizations, whether it's Mexican drug cartels or the Hells Angels or whoever it is, that they're going to just walk away and abandon their efforts to control the drug trade here as well as in Mexico. And I think it's just not practical to think that that's what's going to happen. There's too much money involved, and that there will continue to be a black market for these products.
Well,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Greg, finish your thought. I'm sorry, I thought you were done.
And I apologize, but your third point I blanked on. What was your third point?
That the policy is essentially incoherent.
That we go after the distributors rather than the...
Right.
Yeah.
You have to cut off the demand if you want to stop generating the profits and encouraging the sources of supply.
I agree with the concept that the demand and the consumption absolutely has to be part of the process. The reality is that with limited resources and limited ability to go after it, you have to set priorities. And the concept of going after those who are selling, making millions of dollars selling marijuana or other illegal substances in a practical sense is really the reality in which law enforcement operates.
I mean, let me just add, when I was a prosecutor, I took the confessions from two of the four gang members who brutally stabbed to death three young men who came from the north side of Chicago down into the, from the north suburbs down into the north side of Chicago to buy marijuana. Because marijuana is illegal, they have to go to gangs in order to buy it. They thought they were talking to the Latin Eagles. It turns out they were talking to the Latin Kings, and they pissed them off while they were talking to them, and these kings took them out into the alley and stabbed them to death. The Latin Kings had no marijuana that day. So the laws worked. No marijuana was bought. No marijuana was sold. But these three guys were killed. They were murdered. If they could have gone to what we might call a drugstore and buy marijuana, they'd be alive today. That's what happens when people try to use something, even if it wasn't against the law for them to use marijuana, but it's still against the law for anybody to get it to them, to buy it, to cultivate it, to raise it and distribute it, then they have to deal with the black market, and that's how the black market operates. The mafia no longer makes their money from alcohol. The reason that the only thing that changed was the end of prohibition. They make their money from other prohibited activities, but they don't make their money from alcohol. They might make their money from alcohol that's taxed too high, and they can actually sell untaxed alcohol. But generally speaking, that's not where the mafia gets their money. When marijuana becomes legal, if it were actually legally cultivated and distributed, which it can't be without violating federal law, then you'd strike at the heart of the drug cartels. Profit in marijuana. They would still be able to profit in other things. But marijuana is a very big business because marijuana is very popular, and marijuana is very popular because marijuana is a relatively benign intoxicant as compared with other intoxicants, particularly as compared with the health effects caused by alcohol. So for all those reasons, we do have an irrational policy. I have to agree with David about that. And unfortunately, even with these initiatives, we're going to still have that irrational policy because we're going to have the federal government continuing to perpetuate the black market, which creates these ancillary problems we've been talking about.
On a telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m., we're going to take a closer look at the patent system and some recent articles published by Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Richard Posner, that are getting a lot of attention recently, articles in which he questions some of the underlying value of the patent system. He's going to be featured on the call, that is Judge Posner, along with former Chief Judge of the Federal Circuit, Judge Paul Michel. That's going to be tomorrow at 2 p.m. On Thursday, our schedule continues. Our telephone call on Thursday will take the form of a Second Amendment litigation update. It will focus, among other things, on a recent Seventh Circuit decision, which I think is the first case in which a federal appellate court struck down a statewide concealed carry ban, that ban in Illinois. Our experts are going to be discussing the significance of that decision and whether there's a real circuit split in the wake of the landmark Heller and McDonald cases. So that one's on Thursday at noon. Looks like we've got five callers with questions. Let's go to the next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's discuss for a moment the how this situation works as a nullificatory effort. The obvious way in which it might do that would be that in those states where it is legal under state law, it may become much more difficult for the feds to get juries to convict. And we may also see more defendants refusing plea bargains and instead asking for jury trials with the expectation that their odds are better with a jury. So the ultimate result of that, especially if it spreads to other states, might be the classic exhibition of the nullification process. And, of course, in the process, it would also raise questions about the rationality of the laws that are the enforcement of which is being abandoned.
Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I'll tell you.
Greg knows more about federal juries than I do.
Well, let me tell you how this has worked out in my experience. When I was the DA, we were dealing with the state medical marijuana law, so county elected DA, state marijuana law, and we took a couple cases to trial that we thought were good cases, and guess what? We didn't win because the defense of lawful use and possession and grow under state law was presented as an affirmative defense. So we learned from that, and we became even more judicious in the types of cases that we brought where there was a claim of that. In the federal court, here's the U.S. attorney during my time, we tried multiple cases to juries in which there was an attempt to offer up as a defense compliance with state law. And we were successful in gaining convictions in each and every one of those jury trials, in large measure because the federal judges do not allow the state law into evidence or as an affirmative defense in those cases, and also because the cases that we brought involved people selling millions of dollars worth of marijuana and claiming that they were hiding behind the state law. So I think it depends on the forum. And when you have the state court system and you can offer this up as an affirmative defense, a defendant is in a much stronger position than he or she is in federal court, where it's not relevant, it is not an affirmative defense, and where the feds tend to be far more selective in the cases that they actually bring and prosecute, which typically are going to involve very large sales or gross operations.
And John, as you know, defense attorneys are barred by ethics, ethical rules, to argue nullification to juries. So that's in addition to the fact that they won't be instructed on nullification, and they won't be instructed on the on state laws. They're also the lawyers for the defendants themselves are not going to be able to get up in court and argue for nullification. If juries want to nullify, they're going to have to figure it out all by themselves, and a lot of jurors are not comfortable with that.
However, if there's widespread discussion arising from state legalization, that situation may very well develop.
All right, let's go to our next caller and see what's on their mind.
Yeah, hi, this is Bill Otis. I'm happy to say that I know slightly both of the participants today and have great admiration for both of them. For 4 years in the last administration, I was the counselor to the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration. My view of it, given that experience, is that there is not going to be any federal suit about preemption. There are two reasons for that. One is that, as Randy has pointed out, I think a suit of that kind is pretty problematic. In other words, I think the federal government would stand a better than even chance of losing. The even more important reason that a suit like that will not be brought is that the administration doesn't have a heart for it. I think Obama's constituencies, certainly more so than Republican constituencies, tend to favor legalization of marijuana and are not going to sit easy with the Department of Justice decision to go aggressively after it. The second reason I think that it's not going to happen in reality is that the federal government can continue to do what it's been doing without missing a heartbeat. That is, the real answer to this is not to, or the federal government's answer to this, given the continuing viability and legality of the Controlled Substances Act, is just to keep on doing what they've been doing, which is that simple possession, user amounts of marijuana is not really the subject of federal prosecutions. The feds tend to go only after dealers, and the same policy will continue in the future. I do not agree, however, with Randy's point that regulation by the two states, Colorado and Washington, will help ensure that marijuana is distributed and used in a healthful way. We know what the model for state regulation is by looking at California and California's administration of the Compassionate Use Act and the distribution of medical marijuana. Although regulation was promised the electorate when the electorate adopted the Compassionate Use Act in the mid-1990s, there is no effective regulation, and there was never intended to be, because the people who tend to favor legalized marijuana favor it on the basis that it is no business of the government what you put into your own body. And people who have that thought, and there are a lot of people, many people of good faith and learning have that thought. I don't happen to be one of them. But people who believe that are not going to be in favor of any kind of government regulation. Again, it's up to the individual. And that's what we've seen happen in California. They're just boardwalk vendors for, quote, medical, unquote, marijuana. It's not medical marijuana at all. It's actually recreational marijuana, because there is no effective regulation, none having been intended from the beginning. That same thing is going to happen, I think, in Colorado and Washington, because the same underlying view about legalization and the government's proper role in either criminal or civil regulation of drugs is exactly the same view. And for that reason, you're going to get exactly the same result in terms of the actual non-regulation. The last thing that I want to throw out is I doubt that legalization of marijuana is going to result in taking a big bite out of drug gangs and is going to reduce violence. People who are engaged in rampant murder, like these drug gangs are not going to become peaceable, law-abiding citizens because marijuana gets legalized, if it gets legalized. What they're going to do is move into drugs that are not going to get legalized, like meth and LSD and heroin and cocaine. They'll also move into other forms of illegal conduct, like human trafficking and immigrant smuggling. So there isn't going to be an end to the black market, and there isn't going to be an end to gang violence, even if marijuana is regulated. Again, I appreciate this this forum and the opportunity to hear the responses of Professor Barnett and Scott.
Thanks, Bill. You said a lot there. I'm just going to address a couple of points that you made at the end. Obviously, as long as there are illegal products that people willingly want to buy, there is the there is a black market that will develop, and there will be a premium to be earned from supplying those things. That's just a fact of life. So in that sense, I agree with you. However, I think it's wrong to think that the legalization of the more benign intoxicating substances won't adversely affect the demand for other intoxicating substances. In fact, most people have most of the more dangerous intoxicating substances like PCP and others were invented because of successful or more successful enforcement efforts with respect to the more benign ones. Most people who use intoxicants actually just want to get high. They don't want to hurt themselves. How do we know that? I mean, one great example of that is when the federal government started encouraging the Mexican government and itself was spraying paraquat on Mexican marijuana, which in fact was quite unhealthy if you actually, if that marijuana went to market with the paraquat on it, it was actually carcinogenic and bad for your health. California marijuana consumers started avoiding Mexican marijuana, and instead routes of supply started coming in through Colombia because through the Gulf. Because marijuana consumers in California didn't want to smoke the unhealthful marijuana. It suggests that they wanted to get high, but they didn't want to die. And that means that there is both a demand for a more benign intoxicants as opposed to the more destructive ones or the more dangerous ones, and I think a demand for safe at marijuana. I think people would much rather buy their marijuana at a licensed store where they know that's what they're going to get than from a street vendor where they don't know that's what they're going to get. And so I actually think marijuana consumers and other illicit drug consumers would in fact prefer a regime of health and safety for their marijuana the way they do for their meat and their vegetables. And so I don't think I agree with that, but I think that sort of regulatory regime has to be legal before you're going to see it. But here's the one area in which I agree with Bill. I'm sure that a lot of the impetus for medical, and I think Greg as well, a lot of the impetus for medical marijuana movement has been to eventually legalize it for recreational use. So there isn't as much motivation to restrict the use of marijuana to medical use when, in fact, there's a strong political impulse to have it be used for recreational. So the regulation to draw that line may not have the political force behind it. But I think regulation to ensure that the marijuana that's used is safe and is not getting into the hands of children, I think there would be political demand for that.
Greg Scott, do you want to react here?
Yeah, I think, you know, in a perfect world, the regulatory scheme that Randy describes is what will come to pass in these two states. I think based on our experience here in California, that just isn't going to happen. I mean, we have children who have medical marijuana recommendations, and schools are being asked to accommodate children smoking marijuana. I know that sounds crazy and it sounds extreme, but it's happened. And it's a give an inch, take a mile, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of common sense that factors into the positions that are taken by the advocates here with respect to common sense regulation. And, you know, when you have storefront operations and strip malls operating as marijuana stores selling millions of dollars to anybody essentially who walks in the door, you've got a problem with regulation. When you have, and this happened, I think it was the LA Times did an undercover story on this thing. They got a medical marijuana recommendation for a dog. I think if we could obtain a pure regulatory process, maybe analogous to what is under the guise of the FDA, then maybe we get there. But the way these things have played out in these multiple states over the last several years, California being the most glaring example, it just doesn't work that way. So that would just be a practical observation after having watched what's gone on here for 16 years.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I think we're about to enter the lightning round here. Somehow we still have five questions left. We've got just about 10 minutes, so I'm going to ask the callers to be as quick as possible or as brief as possible with their questions, and we'll try to get through all of them. Let's turn to the next caller.
Hi, thank you very much. This is Will Michella. This is a great conversation. I appreciate it very much. like in following Bill Otis on a point that he made, with his first point with regard to what the Department of Justice's response here. And the one thing that I find wholly unsatisfying with what the department did with regard to medical marijuana is that the Deputy Attorney General couched in a memo the policy of the department in terms of resources. Bill Otis is quite correct, which is they can continue to do that which they're doing. But if they did that in California, they'd be shutting down the medical marijuana dispensaries wholesale, and not when they're doing these other things that Greg says. So I really want to focus on the president's obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and the danger, it seemed to me, or the dubious nature of couching the department's non-enforcement policy in terms of resources, when in fact they have the resources and would have otherwise gone after these major distributors. It seems to me that a more satisfactory or a satisfactory response would have been to do what Bill said, or send an amendment to Congress that said in states that do this, we're not going to, you know, there will be an exception to the Controlled Substances Act. There's also in the federal gambling laws, anti-gambling laws, there's something called the Interstate Gambling Business Act, in which an element of the federal crime is a violation of state laws, and this was to help states enforce their gambling prohibitions to go after La Cosa Nostra. I'm interested in your views on that. So I'm really getting at president's responsibility to take care that the Controlled Substances Act be enforced.
Randy or Greg?
I don't really have a comment. I think we only have like a few more minutes, and we have a lot more people to talk. That was more of a comment than a question, actually.
Okay.
Well, I would just say, Dean, that I think that an earlier caller, I think, made the correct observation that this is a political decision by the administration, if they choose not to do anything about this in some measure, because the president himself has admitted using marijuana heavily as a younger person and has really sent to a certain extent, a signal that this is just not an issue that matters to him. So, and part of his electorate is probably a lot of the people who voted for these propositions in Colorado and Washington. And so there's a political calculus here, and I think Will raises a valid point, which is that, you know, where's that line between political calculus and your constitutional oath? So I just leave it at that.
All right. Next caller.
Thank you. My name is Chuck Wade. I'm in Georgia, and I have a question for both presenters. Professor Barnett said that legalization would be a quote-unquote good experiment, and that phrasing is very clever because experiments are scientific and objective, and they avoid prejudging, so who could oppose them? But isn't legalization of marijuana an experiment that we could not recover from? The reason I say that is because of the unintended consequences of legalization that we could not return from, such as that increase marijuana use by youth. Currently, alcohol kills more kids than all the illegal drugs combined. Millions of kids are smoking tobacco. The U.S. is in the middle of a prescription drug epidemic in which more kids are abusing prescription drugs than ever before. And all of those drugs are legal drugs, which makes access much easier for youth. So we have this enormous underage drinking problem in America. So what makes us think we could really control the sale of legal marijuana to kids? There are millions of kids that don't smoke pot for one reason and one reason only. It's illegal. And doesn't legalizing pot send a message to our kids that we don't think marijuana is harmful, which will result in increased consumption by youth? So the question is, when we realize the mistake of legalization, can we ever go back to prohibition?
Well, I thank Chuck for that comment. I mean, in fact, we're told it's funny because what we're told is when things are made illegal that's an experiment. We have to, and if it doesn't work, we're going to go back the other way. And we never seem to be able to go back the other way. Marijuana only became illegal in the 1930s through a tax act, and it only really became federally against federal law with the Controlled Substances Act in an effective manner in 1970. So, you know, the question is, how well has that worked out for us? And we know there are millions and millions upon millions of people who use marijuana illegally in this country. They're all criminals. If their usage became known, they wouldn't be able to be members of the bar. They wouldn't be able to apply for security clearances and other jobs. If their legal activity became known, that would include the President of the United States, the past President of the United States, many high officials who are only there by the grace of God that they didn't get prosecuted. And I think the other point that you make, Chuck, I think, is that alcohol and tobacco are legal. If you were proposing that we can solve the problem of their abuse by making them illegal, I say we had an experiment and we saw how badly that worked. And we created organized crime in this country that hasn't gone away because they've shifted to other illegal products. But they started off with the alcohol that was made illegal in the 1920s. I will also note, because I feel obligated to, that a constitutional amendment had to be passed in order to make alcohol, give federal government the power to make alcohol legal. Nowadays, we don't have to rely on such niceties because we have the substantial effects doctrine under the Commerce Clause to do it. But so now the federal government does what before it you did a constitutional amendment to do. So I would say experiments run in both directions. The point I was making about experiments was simply that this is going to be two states that are going to do this, and we're going to be able to look and see what happens in two states. The way when we had concealed carry laws in a very few states, it turned out everybody told us that if we had concealed carry, there'd be shootouts over traffic incidents. None of that happened, and as a result now, almost all the states have concealed carry laws because of the experiment that was run in a few states. It turned out the disaster that was predicted did not come true. And that's what we're going to find out in Colorado and Washington. I think that's a good thing.
Greg Scott, you have a comment here?
Only more of a personal one. And I think this concept of what are the unknown consequences of moving away from prohibition. And I, John McKay, who was my colleague as U.S. Attorney in Seattle and was one of the leading proponents of the Washington State Initiative, and I had a long debate at one of our gatherings recently. And my punchline to him was, John, I got three young sons at home. There are enough mines in the minefield to get them from here to there, and legalizing marijuana does not help me to do that in any way, shape, or form. So there is a practical consideration with the children, the minors. There's no doubt in my mind about that, and I don't need any more issues to try to navigate my sons to become successful adults.
All right, looks like we've got two questions remaining. We'll see if we can get to them. Let's go to the next one. If you could be brief, caller.
Hi there. This is Ricky Shaw in California. One thing I noticed was that out here in L.A., a lot of the different municipalities, while it's legal, have allowed business licenses and other ones have not. Do you see that as sort of a distinction that might come down, even if the state and the federal government agree to it, is sort of treated like alcohol licensing, where individual municipalities themselves are still the ultimate parameter?
I believe, with a quick perusal of the Colorado law, that municipalities are not given that discretion. Greg, do you remember what that says?
I thought it said the opposite, but let me look quickly here.
While he's looking, why don't we turn to this final question, and we can take both of them at once if we need to.
Jim Everson in Colorado, what do you folks feel about the Fed's reaction to the cultivation of marijuana, legalizing cultivation of up to six plants in the Colorado law?
I mean, one of the nice things about allowing domestic cultivation is simply that it eliminates the drug trade that comes from other countries, which has proven to be disastrous for us, but even more disastrous for the countries in which are now being basically run by criminal organizations. So I think to the extent that these are jobs that Americans themselves want to do, which is grow their own marijuana, I think that's great. A lot of times people want to do that precisely so that they know they're getting actually pure marijuana, healthy marijuana, not tainted substances. When you buy a bunch of stuff in a bag, you're not sure what's in it. If you grow it yourself, you do. And I continue to insist there's actually a lot of people who use marijuana that are pretty health conscious, and they'd rather use a healthier version of it than one that might be tainted. And going back to the earlier caller, to the extent that the federal government is going to be going after production and distribution, which is their power to do under federal law, the Colorado law will not change that. They are creating the incoherence in the policy that an earlier caller mentioned, and that is that it's going to be great if users don't go to jail, but they're still going to have to deal with criminals in order to federal criminals in order to get their supply, and that works out very poorly, as well as putting profits in the pockets of criminals.
Greg Scott,
I will go back.
Word here.
I'll go back to the example I gave of those three young men who are dead because they had to go to a King Castle hamburger place to try to figure out where to buy marijuana rather than a Walgreens.
Greg Scott, you get the final word here.
Well, it's interesting to me because of the lack of any statewide regulations with respect to how much marijuana someone can possess or grow under California's medical marijuana law, many of the counties and cities in the state have adopted ordinances. And the common number here seems to be six plants, three budding and three in a growth stage. And so it's interesting to me that concept has migrated at least to Colorado, where they can now have these six plants. Although I think we're kidding ourselves if, you know, magically everyone is going to limit themselves to six plants. And there are just other issues with this. There's an incongruity between being able to possess 1 ounce and being able to have three budding plants, because I think if you talk to any reasonable expert on how much usable marijuana bud is developed in a single full mature plant, it's more like a pound comes off of that plant. So there's an incongruity between the number of plants, how much is going to be processed from those plants for usable marijuana, and how much you can lawfully possess. But, you know, Randy's point, I think, is well taken, and I'll just use one startling example. One of the big issues that we confronted here while I was U.S. attorney and continues to be a major issue is that the Mexican drug cartels have converted much of the national forests in the Sierra Pacific mountain range to essentially massive outdoor marijuana grows. And when you go up into these grows, as I have done, you find all kinds of environmental damage with literally bags of fertilizer with skulls and crossbone on them, and stream diversion, clear cutting, all these things. And so, everybody, I guess, wants a clean product, but the idea that we're going to rely exclusively on, you know, grandma growing six plants out back is, I think, rather naive.
Well,
on behalf of Randy, let me give you 30 seconds, Randy, if you could be quick.
Yeah. All I can say is that it is an argument to rely on our normal supply of agriculture. I mean, we rely on the tobacco companies to get us healthful tobacco and without doing environmental damage, and there's no reason why commercial marijuana companies couldn't do the same thing. And then we would have to deal with the social consequences of people wanting to be intoxicated, and I agree with Greg that they're serious ones, especially with our kids. But we wouldn't have to be dealing over and above that with the problems that he just identified, which we do when we make these things illegal.
All right. Well, gentlemen, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both of you, Professor Barnett and Mr. McGregor Scott, for participating in our call today and sharing your expertise. We certainly appreciate it. To our audience, once again, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number, when we'll host Judges Posner and Michelle talking about the patent system. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m., but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.